From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. As we've looked at the subject of nuclear energy on this program and heard from you listeners, it's become clear that there's a lot of confusion about fusion. The quest to tame nuclear energy in this country is a story of competing research efforts and political conflicts. On today's show, I speak with Dr. Norman Rostoker, Professor Emeritus of Physics at the University of California, Irvine. Dr. Rostoker is a representative of a national coalition for alternate fusion research. One researcher who has managed to carry on despite a lack of government funding for his aneutronic fusion technology is Dr. Bogdan Maglich. He is president of Advanced Physics Corporation, and he explains just how this technology works. And if we think that only physicists and congressmen are interested in nuclear energy, I speak with an environmentalist who is better known for his television and film career. Actor Harry Hamlin is a longtime environmentalist and a supporter of emerging technologies which sustain global balance. He speaks about his dedication to energy alternatives. The term nuclear fusion has long evoked images of radioactive nuclear technology. There are, in fact, a number of methods under research. I asked Dr. Rostoker to describe them.
The best known approach is called tokamak, which is a Russian word, and it's originally a Russian idea. It's a donut-shaped container, or it's called a magnetic bottle, and it is used to confine a very hot ionized gas consisting of deuterium and tritium, which, if sufficiently hot and dense, will react. It has had most of the studies and most of the money, probably about $20 billion has been invested in it throughout the world, and in a way the furthest along. The main point about it, it is abundantly clear now, is it has to be awfully large. For instance, there's an international tokamak that's being planned now, with many countries contributing, and this thing is going to be 100 foot high by 100 foot in diameter, and it will be expensive. Now, there are a number of other approaches, including one I'm interested in called the self-collider. And the main difference in this is that it uses much higher energy particles, and it is possible to make a small reactor that isn't 100 feet high by 100 foot in diameter, more like 10 feet high and 10 feet in diameter. That's one other approach that myself and Bogdan Maglich of Applied Physics Corporation pursue. Another approach is called inertial fusion, and that's essentially a tiny hydrogen bomb where one compresses nuclear material consisting of mainly deuterium and tritium, people think about, to a high enough density so it isn't really confined except by its mass for a very short time, like 10 picoseconds, but it's at high enough temperature and density to react, and it's like a little tiny bomb.
Cold fusion is also another alternative, right?
Cold fusion is a very interesting idea that received a great deal of publicity about 2 years ago. For about 6 months, it was extremely exciting. However, there was never a shred of evidence that anything nuclear was going on. And today, it is still pursued. Interest was lost in it because there weren't any repeatable experiments. But now there are. In my opinion, it has nothing to do with nuclear fusion, though. In my opinion, it's the origins of the energy are chemical. Some of the proponents of cold fusion today would agree with me in some papers, but most would not. Most believe that there is something nuclear going on, although of a profoundly different character than anything we've observed before, because there's no evidence of reaction products that one expects from fusion.
Now, are there any other primary research approaches?
Well, there are variations of there's a group at the University of Washington that studies something called a field reverse configuration. At Oak Ridge, people study something called a stellarator. And these are variations on magnetic confinement systems that may have considerable advantages in a power reactor eventually. They're not strongly supported anymore. In fact, they're really not supported hardly at all. The field reverse configuration studies at University of Washington are studied under the guise of as an injector for a tokamak, because several years ago, the Department of Energy decided to support nothing but tokamak and canceled all other contracts. However, during the past year, there have been a small amount of money has been made available, about $1 million for the country, to investigate ideas other than tokamak.
Well, that's rather interesting to me. I think the first thing that's interesting is for the layperson, I think they think nuclear fusion. And some people may think, cold fusion, I've heard of that. And
yes.
It's like, okay. But there are a whole number of scientific approaches at this point. They're all in the research phase, all of them in the research phase. And secondly, to realize that the primary portion of the, $360 million annual budget goes to all but $1 million is going to the tokamak research.
That's correct.
Which uses the deuterium tritium combination, and the tritium is a radioactive fuel.
Yes, it's quite worrisome too, because it has a long half-life of 12 years, and if it gets around, hydrogen is a part of everybody's chemistry. And the fact the fuel is radioactive is troublesome, and the fact that most of the energy is produced in the form of neutrons, which activate everything in sight. Although there are materials that aren't activated very much, and the Department of Energy is counting on them to keep down the induced radioactivity. But there's nothing. If you're going to use tritium, you have to learn to live with handling it.
Now, you recently founded a coalition representing the alternate nuclear fusion research. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the coalition.
Well, there are a number of scientists, and some quite distinguished, who believe that there should be more effort on something that's more environmentally acceptable. Most of us believe that power reactors, if they are ever to be acceptable to the public, have to use a different reaction, dehelium-3. Next week, there's a meeting at the University of Wisconsin where there are study projects on dehelium-3 reactors. My main interest and that of Dr. Maglic is in the self-collider, because it's appropriate for dehelium-3. You have to use higher energies. And so the coalition involves a group of scientists who believe that we should be studying this reaction instead of deuterium-tritium. And
is helium-3 radioactive?
No. Helium-3 is not radioactive. The fuel is not radioactive. There are some neutrons produced by side reactions of deuterium with deuterium, but the amount of radioactivity induced for a given material is at least 1,000 times less than it would be with deuterium-tritium. And also there are reactions that could be studied further, like just helium-helium. There's no radioactivity at all. And although that's further in the future. Now, the Department of Energy used to support research on dehelium-3. They don't now. Absolutely nothing. They stopped because they said there isn't any helium-3. It's a fairly rare rare isotope of helium, but it's not a fact. There actually is quite a lot of helium-3 found naturally. There's no tritium found naturally. But it isn't obvious that you could mine it economically, because nobody has really studied the possibility of mining it, although there have been quite a few studies since they stopped supporting it about the availability on Earth. But perhaps the most interesting thing, which is to many people, which is pursued in University of Wisconsin, is the possibility of mining the moon. When the astronauts went to the moon, they brought back rocks. And those rocks have a high concentration of helium-3, much higher than typical rocks on Earth. It should be possible, particularly with some of the new ideas around today, to develop a concept that's much more acceptable environmentally. We who are interested in this coalition for alternate concepts are trying to propose that a study be made by the National Academy of Sciences of alternate concepts, because we think this question should be addressed. So we think that there should be a National Academy study and then a separate group to support alternate fusion ideas. I like to compare this to many years ago, the War Department only supported balloons and dirigible research for flight. And there was an alternate concept for flight, which was discovered by the Wright brothers. And I like to think that this is similar. We have that was an alternate concept for flight, which, by the way, was never supported in the early years by the United States government. The Wright brothers had to go to France to get support. That was a very important alternate concept that did manage to get developed. And we think that alternate concepts involving more environmentally acceptable fuels should also be supported.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and I'm speaking with Dr. Norman Rostoker, Professor Emeritus of Physics at the University of California, Irvine, and recipient of the Maxwell Prize in Plasma Physics. In your recent testimony before Congress, you mentioned that tritium experiments, that's the radioactive tritium experiments, are scheduled to be conducted at the Tokamak reactor at Princeton University, and that's, I think, the Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory. And presumably, this is all funded under the federal government fusion research program, it is. And you noted in your testimony, and I'll quote here, that after the experiments are completed, it is expected that the laboratory will be closed because of the radioactivity for 9 years. What do you mean the laboratory will be closed?
Well, there are a lot of neutrons produced with these experiments. There will be a lot of induced radioactivity, and it won't be a suitable place to continue to do experiments. It will become a problem of exposure to personnel, unless there's quite a large investment in shielding and facilities for handling radioactivity. Unless this very large investment is made, and probably it's more convenient to make a modest investment and do these experiments, which are about 100 shots or so, 150 shots, and then just wait for the whole laboratory to cool off and go work somewhere else. I would guess it's cheaper to do that.
So the current plan is to do the experiments, happen very quickly.
The plan to do the experiments is a fact.
That they are going to shut it down.
I don't have direct information on this, but I gave a reference in that written testimony, which is to an article in Science magazine, which describes this, what to expect.
So the current plan, as far as you know it, is to shut it down for 9 years?
Yeah, so after doing these experiments, to close down the laboratory that contains this experiment.
Well, I have a question that perhaps shouldn't be directed at you, but I think it might be fun to discuss it. If the state of this technology is such that we can't conduct the experiment without shutting down the laboratory for 9 years, why don't we either wait until the technology to either restore or clean up or cleanse the equipment has been developed, or we invest the money to make sure that we don't shut it down? Why wouldn't we wait until that was in place?
Well, I believe the technology for handling tritium and the radioactivity exists. But I believe, I don't know for a fact, but I believe that the answer is that it's a considerably greater investment than the government wants to make at this time. That they simply want to get results from these experiments, and in the machine called the TFTR, the Tokamak Fusion Test Reactor, it's called at Princeton, which is at the end of its lifetime anyway. That is, they feel they've done all they can with this stage of development of this machine, and this is the one thing they can do with it that is valuable, and it makes more sense economically to not put in place all of the technology for handling everything, which would mean remote handling equipment and all sorts of things which are quite expensive, although they exist. I think it's an economic decision.
So because the equipment is coming to the end of its
useful
life.
It's coming to the end of its useful life anyway.
We'll perform the experiments and we'll just simply shut the lab for 9 years.
Yeah, to put in place all the equipment and remote handling equipment and so on would be extremely expensive. If one infers from this discussion that the handling of the radioactivity is a problem, one has come to a correct conclusion.
Well, I was wondering if there'd been any reaction from the citizens of Princeton or the students of the university regarding, this radioactive experiment. I mean, it is rather alarming if someone says, as we're going to shut this laboratory down for 9 years. It's like that does get your attention.
Yeah, well, it isn't quite as sensational as it sounds. I hope that, although I'm not directly associated with it in any way, I hope I described that it is a more or less sensible economic decision. I think it's a safe decision, but the residents of Princeton might still be inquisitive about it, and well, they should be. But I think when it's explained to them, it will probably not be a problem.
So you personally aren't alarmed about that?
No.
The Electric Power Research Institute, EPRI, representing the private utility companies in the United States, supported the tokamak research early on. However, 10 years ago, it withdrew its support and has remained non-supportive. EPRI has stated that the private utilities will not use this device, even if it were available. And yet Senator Bennett Johnson has introduced legislation, which was just passed by the Senate and is now proceeding on to the House, which restricts all fusion research funds to the tokamak research. And these utilities, here we have the utilities saying, we won't use it. And the federal government's basically saying, well, we won't fund or work on anything else. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars here. How could we be in such a situation?
Perplexing, isn't it?
Yes, I find it very, I'm very confused by it.
Your facts are absolutely correct. And I find it, and have been speaking to this point for some time, for the last few years, that it makes no sense whatever to put so much of our wealth and effort into something where there's no agreement that it has any future. Now, there needs to be more interaction between EPRI and the Department of Energy. I believe that this impasse isn't useful or constructive for anybody. And probably both are rather inflexible. I believe that, well, personally, I believe that tokamak research should go on because so much has been learned from it. But it should be research. And I think EPRI should encourage it and perhaps support research in tokamaks. But both should support research in alternate concepts. And so that we might eventually get a reactor out of it that utilities would use.
Well, my experience in science and technology is that we don't know where we're going to get the answers to many things by simply traveling along a straight line. Mm-hmm. That quite often you do several things that are actually looking in one direction, and you learn something that helps you and something you're working on in another direction.
Absolutely. And the trouble is, in this field, the amount of research that now takes place is rather small. So even supporting research for tokamaks isn't very much. And I don't think that the science or the technology is yet at hand that will ultimately lead to us solving our energy problems on a long-term basis. And I don't think there's any other technology except fusion which offers even this possibility. We simply can't go on burning fossil fuels and with a growing population. And, the fission reactor industry is a lesson of if you don't learn about history, you'll just repeat it. Well, the history of fission reactors is very similar. I was involved in it. I worked at General Atomic during the 50s and early 60s on fission reactors. At that time, they decided to put all efforts into light pressurized water reactors, and everything else almost everything else was terminated. And that brings us to today, where we have a moribund industry. It really is a technology that works, but it hasn't got enough public acceptance, and some mistakes have been made. And furthermore, the kind of reactor that was built isn't optimum from a point of view of safety or economy because of focusing effort. We seem to, particularly when science interacts with politics, there seem to be a great premium in focusing the effort and many people believe that this is economic. This is an economic way to do it. Focus the effort, get rid of everything else, just use the thing that works or seems to work at the time. And, in the case of the fission reactors, we must have wasted hundreds of billions of dollars. That's not economics.
Well, it sort of speaks to this new legislation, which was introduced by Senator Johnson here in 1993, when in fact we have in the Energy Policy Act of 1992, which mandates broad-based fusion energy programs. So that rather suggests that in a year we figured out what we wanted to do.
Well, these two pieces of legislation are in direct contradiction with each other. They have yet to meet each other in the House. And perhaps it will turn out to be the case of an irresistible force acting on an immovable object.
Now, you've published 107 technical papers. Mm-hmm. And your first paper was published in 1950, and it was entitled "The Distribution of Potential in a Two-Layered Medium Due to an Internal Source and Sink," and stop, it gets better, "The Determination of the Approximate Average Resistivity of the Medium." And I have to tell you that I read all the way through 107, and your titles just don't get better. I mean, a few of them I couldn't read. I think my question is do you look back on all these papers and the research and say, well, what do you expect? I mean, I've been working over 40 years on this. Or do you look back on that body of work with some, you know, real satisfaction?
Well, my career has spanned the golden age of science, and I'm very fortunate to have been able to spend my career where my profession and my hobby were the same thing, and I got paid well for doing what I consider fun. And I think that this has been a golden age for physics, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's nearly over. Sometimes I call this the post-scientific era, because most of the best people are spending all their time writing proposals and trying to get money. I think we have produced so many physicists now, if they were all supported, they'd probably use up the budget of the United States.
Darn those physicists. Well, now you're now a professor emeritus, and if you were a diplomat, this means they put flags on your car. I mean, this is the highest you can get here in academic circles. Has that changed anything for you?
Yeah. I think every job has some things which are fun and some which are work. I've been teaching classes in university for 47 years. And I consider classroom teaching work by now. And I don't have to do it anymore. Now I can spend all my time pursuing my own ideas. There's no relationship between my work and my income. That's a marvelous arrangement. I'm not quite used to it yet. I'm still pinching myself, but I'm enjoying it thoroughly.
Dr. Rostoker, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Dr. Norman Rostoker is Professor Emeritus of Physics at the University of California at Irvine and a representative of a national coalition for alternate fusion research. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn. One of the alternate fusion technologies being researched is called aneutronic nuclear fusion. Pioneered by Dr. Bogdan Maglich, it uses helium-3 in a collider to create energy. I asked Dr. Maglich how the helium-3 collider approach works.
Helium-3 is a natural non-radioactive isotope of the helium-4. It is a rare isotope but actually in the interior of the Earth, in the Earth's crust, it exists 1,000 times in larger concentrations than on the surface. And it comes out from the sea bottoms and through the geysers.
Through the geysers. Old Faithful produces helium.
For instance, the deep diving submarine in 1978 that dove to 4,000 meters depth came back with 1,000 times more saturated seawater with helium-3 than on the surface. So helium-3 does exist in nature. It exists in atmosphere. There are about 4,000 tons of helium-3 in the atmosphere, which would be enough to power the entire Earth's electricity production for about 100 years. And inside the Earth crust, there are about between 1 and 10 million estimated tons, which would be enough for 10,000 years of total electricity supply. More importantly, fusion fuel is easy to breed, and you can breed helium-3 from ordinary water by, again, having a device in which it could be bred. The same is true of tritium, except that tritium does not exist in nature. The only way to get it is it has to be bred. Well, helium-3 exists in nature. Also, enormous concentrations of helium-3 exist on the surface of the moon. But the most practical source is to breed it. Now, what is the difference between the tritium fusion of the DOE and helium-3 fusion? Everybody recognizes that the helium-3 fusion is superior, but helium-3 fusion, in order to ignite, in order that the engine fueled by it ignite, it requires 10 times higher temperature than tritium fusion. Tritium fusion requires 100 million degrees centigrade. Helium-3 fusion requires 1 billion degrees centigrade. And so that was the reason that it was decided first to develop radioactive neutronic fusion, and then, this is the theory of the DOE, this would be served as a stepping stone to develop the non-radioactive, the helium-3 fusion. Therefore, it was just a decision. Yes, helium-3 fusion is superior, but it has to wait till we reach these temperatures. What actually has happened, you know, physics is a dynamic science. Overnight, things happen that suddenly change the whole picture. And in the 70s, a new technology in nuclear physics took place, so-called colliders. In colliders, atomic nuclei coast inside magnetic rings, and they coast in opposite directions and therefore collide head-on against each other. This is equivalent to enormous temperatures in hundreds of billions of degrees. Therefore, what actually completely changed this picture of needing to wait to reach these temperatures is that instead of heating the fuel, which is the process in H-bomb and in the National Fusion Program, instead of heating fuel, we fire atomic nuclei head-on against each other. And we have routinely in our laboratory for the past 12 years, 14 years, obtained temperatures of 10 billion degrees routinely within minutes, equivalent. This is called equivalent temperatures. In other words, in order to achieve these collisional speeds that we have achieved, a plasma would have to be heated to 10 billion degrees. So we have just jumped this main barrier to a neutronic fusion or to non-radioactive fuel fusion.
Okay, so let me just recount this so that we're all on the same level here. The original way that we cause the nuclear reaction to take place is to heat to a very high temperature. And the tritium actually will combust. That's probably the wrong word.
Good word,
it's a good enough word. Sure, okay, sure. It will combust at a much lower temperature than the helium-3. And so if we're just looking at the technology as time marched along, the earlier technology certainly had, it was easier to reach the lower temperature than it was the higher temperature for any reason. And we don't care how we reach that temperature. If you have to heat it, you're going to give off a lot of heat and you got to spend a lot of fuel getting up to that heat. But if you can have a different technique to create the equivalent of heat, that's even better. And what's happened in the meantime is colliders. And then the listeners to this program, we've talked about the super collider where the electrons, they're in a magnetic field and they go in different. Pretty soon everybody says, let's let's hit each other, and bang, they do, and there we have a collision.
Exactly. We have borrowed our ideas for the so-called self-collider fusion reactor. We have borrowed it from the colliders, the superconducting supercollider being an example. But of course, in the 70s, the first collider was built in Geneva, Switzerland, where I happened to have worked then, and we immediately started thinking how to adopt it, and there the ring in which the particles circulated and were colliding was 300 meters in diameter. We made a system which was 10 centimeters in diameter. So we have copied some of the collider ideas and quickly obtained temperatures in billions of degrees.
So that we've made the breakthrough in the heating by not heating at all, but by colliding.
Right.
And instead of having to have a huge collider, now we're going to a small collider.
Small collider. This is another difference. If you are heating the fusion fuel like tritium, again, one is imitating the H-bomb. How H-bomb works. H-bomb works is that it consists of atom bomb. In the midst of it is the fusion fuel. And this fusion fuel is heated by an explosion of the atom bomb, which in turn now produces enough heat to trigger the combustion of hydrogen fuel. So it's a two-step process. So people since 1950s have started imitating the H-bomb by various means. We have done away with all this. We found it totally unnecessary because we could fire against each other. And now we arrive at another property. In order to heat the nuclear, the fusion reactor, the reactor has to be very, very large. The walls have to be far away from the reacting volume. So the whole tenet for the last 40 years of the National Fusion Program is that the tokamak or fusion will work if the reactor is large. The larger it is, the more likely it will work. So the more billions of dollars per device, the better it works. So it started in the 70s with the hundreds of millions of dollars. Now the new tokamak is to cost about $10 billion. It would be an enormous machine, which would be a giant, and even this is not sure it will work, but it is surer because it's bigger.
Has helium-3 in a collider situation been demonstrated physically?
We have on one occasion injected helium-3. What our aim is, of course, to show that we can reach these temperatures and certain densities, and therefore it is automatic that when you have the given temperatures of 10 billion degrees and certain densities that the reactor will work. So in order to save money, and because we are funded only privately, we were going sparingly on helium-3, which is more expensive than deuterium that is derived from seawater. Therefore, my answer is yes, we have used helium-3, but in most of the experiment, we had used cheaper fuel, the deuterium, heavy water.
But you have built a collider.
Oh, we have built four colliders. And Dr. Rostocker at the University of California in Irvine has built two similar colliders, working on a somewhat different principle.
Okay, so there's a number of colliders out there which are receptive to helium-3.
Right.
And you have fed helium-3 into the colliders, and what has been the result?
Well, we have obtained the reactions that release energy. We have demonstrated that the system is stable. This is more important. That it can stay together, this fuel at these enormous temperatures stays together 23 seconds in our experiment. In tokamaks, less than 1 second. We have 20 times longer time of confinement, which is called confinement time, and we have 100 times higher temperature than achieved in tokamaks, but we have densities still 1,000 times lower than those needed for the reactor.
Now, I don't understand the density issue.
Oh, density, you can just think of compressing the fuel in your engine. In order to have a helium-3 ignite, combust, if you want to say, you have to have a high compression engine. You cannot put in tokamak helium-3 fuel. It would be like putting low-grade gasoline in a high compression engine. You need super gasoline to put in an engine that has high compression. So the helium-3 reactor must have high compression and high temperature.
My interpretation of this is that we have these helium-3 molecules running around, and they're colliding.
Nuclei.
Right. Thank you.
Right.
And to get the maximum collision, you've got to have a certain density. Is that right?
Yeah. To get more energy out that is put in.
To maximize.
Yes,
you have to have good density.
You have good density, and many listeners will understand that the power produced is proportional in colliding beams to density squared. So when we get 10 times more density, we get 100 times more energy out. So we need 1,000 times more density. We have increased the density in self-collider since 1973, 100 million fold. And we now need 1,000 fold increase. And for the last 10 years, we were unable to get funds to do that because we don't have a big enough injector, the booster of fuel. The injector of fuel is required 20 times more powerful than we had until now, and we were unable to get funds for it.
Okay, so the engineering questions left, some of them are the injector system and the size and that type of thing. But you have demonstrated it, and you have sustained ignition for 23 seconds.
There are three things. One is compression, which is density, mm-hmm. temperature, and time. These three factors. Two, we have exceeded anything else by very large factor. The third one, we are below. And as I say, the only reason we are below because our injector was too poor. Okay. Our booster was poor.
How much money do you need to do what in the short term?
We have completed four stages of research, and the next one is just to increase this density. And this is a three-year, $30 million project.
3 years, $30 million
yes.
In total?
In total, yes. And we have submitted a proposal to the Department of Energy. We submitted it because when we testified before the Congress in April 1992, both Professor Rostocker of University of California and myself testified, stating that the Department of Energy automatically rejects proposals that are with non-radioactive fuel. Then the Department of Energy wrote to the Congress, if they submit a proposal, we will review it. Before, they wouldn't even review it. We submitted a proposal amounting to $30 million over 3 years, University of California and Advanced Physics, two separate proposals, but under the same letter. And to this date, they have not reviewed it. They have not started reviewing it. This is another method here. So we cannot say they turned us down, but the thing sits there now already 8 months, and they haven't started reviewing it. But in the meanwhile, they asked us to withdraw the proposal and to submit much smaller, like $300,000 or $400,000 proposal. We didn't withdraw that one because it's impossible to do $30 million job for $200,000 or $300,000, but we submitted a lesser proposals. And
an additional proposal.
An additional proposal for lesser work, and we will see what happens. But we already have signals that they will be turned down on political grounds.
Dr. Maglich, thank you so much for joining us.
Dr. Bogdan Maglich is president of Advanced Physics Corporation. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. The impression of the general public is that nuclear energy proponents and environmentalists don't mix. But is it nuclear energy per se, or rather the dangers of radioactivity, which has long been associated with nuclear energy, that is at the heart of the argument? Actor Harry Hamlin is a committed environmentalist dedicated to making the planet safer and cleaner. I asked him about his involvement in aneutronic fusion technology.
I met the inventor of this program in 1980 in Rome, and I had a long discussion with him then about the technology. He explained that it was non-radioactive and that it was non-polluting, and at that time I was a budding environmentalist, and it seemed to me as though this might be just the thing that the world needs in order to avoid the kind of egregious pollutants that we have manufactured as a result of our energy production since we began creating electricity. Certainly with all of the talk about greenhouse gases and global warming and nuclear proliferation and nuclear waste disposal problems, an alternative like this sounded very attractive to me.
You have a pretty interesting background that I don't think many people realize. Your father was a rocket scientist, designed the fuel injectors on the Saturn V. Your brother is a robotics engineer. You yourself have a degree from Yale, and you were a recipient of a Fulbright. I can only imagine the conversations around your dinner table.
Yeah. Well, if I'm having dinner with just my dog in the room, it's pretty quiet. But in fact, I am a conversationalist, and I love to have people around who are interested in issues and topics that I find interesting, and sometimes we can burn the midnight oil.
And with that family background, you chose to become an actor, and I don't think I have to tell you that actors are not generally thought of as rocket scientists. And in your support of the environment, as well as this technology and other technologies, you spend a good deal of the time explaining very complicated concepts. Do you find that people are surprised at the knowledge that you have about this?
Well, I think that people do have preconceived notions about various professions. I think actors are probably conceived as being good at one thing and maybe not good at other things. I don't know in terms of describing very complex issues how good I am at that. I sometimes surprise myself. But in this case, I'm so dedicated to putting forward this technology and getting the attention of not only the government but also the American people that I have done a tremendous amount of research on it, and my vocabulary on the subject is much broader now than it was 10 years ago. So I have been able to become a little bit fluid, and I hope that when I do describe it to people, they get the general drift.
I'm interested in who nationally and in the international community supports the pursuit of this technology.
Well, in fact, not since the Manhattan Project has there been such a large and distinctive number of scientists and physicists behind one single project. We now have not only Glenn Seaborg, who was chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission under three presidents and won the Nobel Prize for his part in the discovery of plutonium. We have Dr. Seaborg, we have Dr. Murray Gell-Mann, who is in some circles considered the greatest living physicist since Einstein. I know he'd like me for saying that. We have Dr. Lawrence Litsky from MIT, who is one of the greatest plasma physicists in the country. We also have, in addition to that, 100 Russian nuclear physicists who have come on board. The Chelyabinsk 70 lab in Russia, which was the lab responsible for building the bomb there, has decided to retool much of its operation to get behind this project. There are many members of the consortium, from scientists to industry. General Electric Research and Development is behind us. The number of people is staggering. And I don't know if we have enough time to go through it today, but it is suffice it to say that the technology has gained the attention of all of these world-renowned nuclear physicists and institutions, and it's now our task to get the attention of the federal government and have them come on board as well, helping us with funding so that we can move ahead expeditiously.
Well, if this technology, non-radioactive nuclear fusion using some kind of a collider technology, can be made to work, how would it change our lives and how would it affect the total environment?
Well, I think you have to start from the top down. First of all, there would be no radioactive pollution. There would be no need to dispose of radioactive waste. Second to that, there would be no nuclear proliferation possibilities, so that we could export these reactors to developing countries without the fear that they were going to use them and convert them to make bombs. Below that, there's no heat pollution from these reactors, or a minimal amount of heat pollution relative to what reactors today are creating. So that in terms of the global warming aspect of it, there would be a very small impact. Then below that, the reactors are very small. Each one conceived to be smaller than an individual container, which means that they can be exported easily from one place to another, manufactured in one central location, let's say, and exported to another country or another location within the same country. They can be stacked if one wants to create a greater focal point for energy production. They can stack 100 reactors in one spot, and from that you create a grid that goes out and powers a city, let's say. However, I think that the reactors are designed to be used individually, so that in each home or business would have its own power source that would be serviced by a power company. At least that's one of the ways that we envision using the technology. That would, of course, if that were the case, eliminate power lines as they now run across the country and destroy our view, etc. So there are a lot of ways that our lives would be changed if this technology came into play.
Would it affect cars? Would it affect buses?
Well, there
is that a possibility?
Well, there is talk. I mean, one of the companies that's in the consortium would like to develop the reactors to power engines for trains. Certainly, you could power, if you had a large enough vehicle at the moment, you could use a reactor like this to create the electricity to power electric motors, as in trains or in space vehicles, for example, or if nuclear submarines. There are any number of applications on that large scale. In terms of building a reactor that's small enough in and of itself to power an automobile, that still is technology that's in the future. It would be a miniaturization process. But, I mean, if we have seen them go from computers that were the size of warehouses to a computer that you can wear on your wrist now, so the idea of that happening isn't too
far-fetched. Sort of the natural progression of technology.
Seems to be that it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So we could eventually someday be looking at an electric car that's powered by one of these reactors. I think for the moment, though, what we're looking at is using the reactor to create electricity to charge batteries, and that the batteries would then be used to power the car.
There's a couple of things that occur to me here. The first is the issue of heat. This kind of technology goes directly to electricity. It doesn't produce heat that we've got to then convert into electricity. And one of the reasons I brought up the car issue is we sit here in the middle of San Francisco, and all our cars are driving around. You get out of your car, you feel that heat. You go to your house, you generate all this heat. And 200 years ago, there were just a few people standing on the hills here. And when I look at just the heat that's generated by all of us living here now versus 200 years ago in what we consider a very benign way, and what that's giving off to the environment, it's like, if we could just get rid of the heat, that would just be at least some contributor. So that's one issue. And then the other issue that hits me is since the big Hoover Dam and all those kind of things, we build these huge power plants and these huge grids that send electricity out. And the idea that we wouldn't need huge networks to distribute power really changes the whole structure of the United States and the world. But also, you really couldn't take like a city's power out. You couldn't really control like half the state. You know, all of Northern California doesn't have any energy right now because of a big storm or something like that. It really changes what affects what.
That's right. We wouldn't be dependent upon an energy grid per se. But each power source would be individual in and of itself. And it would definitely change the whole landscape of the United States when you're talking about not having huge power poles and networks of lines carrying electricity from one place to another. But be that as it may, no matter how many Hoover dams we build or nuclear power plants, light water fission power plants we build, there will always be need for more. And we're running out of rivers to dam up, and there are laws now that prohibit us from doing that. So the only alternative really to creating new sources for electricity production is to burn more coal on the one hand, or create more light water fission power plants. Light water fission is not very popular right now with the utility companies or the public, and I don't think we'll be seeing too many of those being built over the next 100 years or so, which means that the only real alternative will be coal. And hopefully we can create an alternative to that, because we all know that the the gathering of coal pollutes the environment by strip mining, and the burning of coal pollutes the environment by creating greenhouse gases that eventually contribute to global warming. So we have to come up with an alternative to that. Any reasonable alternative should be looked at. Any ideas that that have behind them the great minds supporting them, or government bodies supporting them, or any ideas that present in even a modicum of feasibility should be looked at and should be given a chance to succeed, because the alternative is really far too frightening and far too terrifying to let any of these things go.
Let me just ask you one last question here. Here in the United States, we often kind of turn on ourselves and look at ourselves and don't want to look at the rest of the world. We don't want to look at the global environment. And part of that is because you don't have to raise your head too high when they say, well, you guys got all the cars and you're burning all the gasoline and you're, you know, burning coal and you're doing all that kind of stuff. Such a technology as non-radioactive fusion eliminates a lot of that, and it would substitute some of that effect on the world. If we just eliminate or reduce that in the United States, will that reduce it for the rest of the world as well? Are we the biggest sinners here, or
well,
what's the story?
It will certainly help if we do it in this country, and at the moment we're one of the prime users of coal, and we are one of the prime contributors to that production of greenhouse gases, but it's going on all over the world. And an interesting statistic has recently surfaced out of China, and that is that the Chinese government has decided to raise their per capita usage of electricity from 5% of what Americans use on a daily basis, which is what it is today, to 50% of what Americans use on a daily basis in 20 years, which is a huge project for them, a huge undertaking. But China has the capability to do it because they have the resources of coal, and all they need to do is just build huge coal burning power plants and then get their grid together, and they'll have their power usage go up by this, you know, whatever they want. Unfortunately, if you apply all the figures, the population figures, et cetera, to that equation, you get a huge burning of coal, and you'll get a huge pollution of the environment from that burning. We need to, before the Chinese get too deeply involved in burning this coal, come up with an alternative. Because no matter what we do in the Western world to reduce the greenhouse gases, the effect of their coal burning processes will obliterate what we have done.
So in addition to committing ourselves in the U.S. to try to do what we can do and to move this technology forward, we have to be committed on a global basis to try to make all of the technologies that help us live work together on a global basis.
I believe that should be our primary concern right now.
Harry, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Harry Hamlin. This past April, he testified before the House of Representatives Subcommittee on Energy and Water. Special thanks to KLON Long Beach and to KUCI at the University of California at Irvine. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.